Please join me in welcoming our speaker this evening, Tom Ive from the Primary Purpose Group from Southern Pines, North Carolina.
My God, I thought there was a 10-minute speaker. I was going to make up a big speech. I'm Tom Ivester, an alcoholic. And I am a member of the Primary Purpose Group in Southern Pines, North Carolina. Delighted to be here. And I tell you, this is a busy meeting. Feel like I've already been to a full service here. Congratulations to all of the celebrants tonight. That was just great to see. And I believe this thing works. Sure looks like it. Good evidence. And it is a pleasure to be here. A pleasure to be in Oregon. When I left North Carolina yesterday, it was 104 degrees. Humidity was 104, I think. It's a real pleasure to be here. And great to be back at this group. It's just super to see a Saturday night open meeting with a lot of folks here and couples here. And just super. It's a beautiful sight. This is what AA ought to look like. And what we're doing here tonight, for my money, is the purest form of AA, where one of us just sort of opens up and tells about ourselves to others. And that's what this is all about. It's not about making speeches. It's about sharing about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And so that's what I want to do. I want to go at it. I know some of you folks do some speaking too. And you probably run into the same thing I do. I'm so fascinated with drunkalogs, particularly mine, that I just get in it and just love it. I could just wallow around in it forever and will if I get a chance. And if it is frustrating because I don't get enough time to talk about the life that comes. And so tonight I'm going to do something just a little bit different than I normally do. I'm going to do the same thing, but in a little different form. I'm going to kind of try to weave together a little bit. So instead of trying to proportion it out, I'll try to do it together and kind of weave it together. Now, I don't know what will come out. God knows. It may be like making sausage. I have no idea what this will look like. But let's take a look at it anyway. Yeah, I was a guy, when I got started in this program, I was a guy who found himself at the age of 24 at a point in life when most folks are just getting started to live, that are just getting ready to start out on a career, finishing up college, getting married, starting a family, all of that normally occurs in those early 20s. And when I was 24 years old, I was sitting in a maximum custody penitentiary recognizing the fact that my life was not beginning. It was over. It was done. And I absolutely was resigned to my fate. I was sitting in that penitentiary and knew without any question that I would never get out of there alive. And had no real reservations about that because I felt like I was exactly where I deserved to be. I was sitting there, I could tell you, and with all honesty, that I was there because of a tragic, unavoidable accident. But the fact of the business is, I don't know. What I did was what countless alcoholics do all too often in this country, where many alcoholics do. Thank God most don't do what I did and what many others do, and that was wake up from a blackout, which was no novelty to me. Normally I would wake up, come out of a blackout with a sort of panicky feeling of trying to put together what have I done this time. And always before it had always been just what might have happened and never had. But this last time that I was in a blackout, I came to and was greeted with the fact that driving blind drunk down the main street of a city, I had run over and killed two people in the street whose only mistake was trying to cross the street where I happened to be trying to drive. And so certainly I don't have any doubt that it was an unavoidable accident, but when a guy like me takes a vehicle out on the street and tries to point it down, you might as well fire a weapon down the street. It's just as much of an accident. So in that sense, it was not a tragic accident. It was just one of those tragedies that comes out of alcoholism from time to time. And so that's who I was. I was sitting there with a life that had been culminated with that kind of an event. And I was absolutely devastated, as you can imagine. I was not somebody. I was not a predatory criminal. I was not a gangster. I was sort of a social wrecking ball, but I never did any predatory type of crime. I was just an alcoholic who just screwed up everything he got close to, is what I did. And so that's what I looked at, as the life that had ended like that. And when I look back at that life, any way I looked was an unpleasant place to look. When I look back at what the life had been, it was best left unobserved. Because in the first 24 years of my life, and this is a God's truth, it's not melodrama, it's the God's truth. In the first 24 years of my life, I couldn't think of one redeeming thing that I had ever done. I mean, anything that I had done to satisfaction, to completion, with any sense of pride or accomplishment. I mean, not one. Never held a job for as much as a year in my life. Except the Army, and I didn't want to hold that one. I tried to quit on a regular basis. I liked it for about 30 minutes when I joined. Then I met the first guy in charge, and that sucker started talking to me like a dog, and I'd never seen him before. So I said, man, this is not for me. I'm here to defend my country or something. And tried to quit. Every time I'd quit, they'd come get me and put me in jail. And so I finally quit quitting. And then I stayed there for 38 months. Yeah, it's a strange thing. I mean, I was a real turkey, but like a lot of other alcoholics that I've become acquainted with over the years, I was somebody who, at least people saw me as somebody with a lot of potential. I had two or three people tell me I had real potential. I had a few hundred that told me I was the biggest turkey they'd ever seen. But I'd had a couple tell me that I was a guy with a lot of potential. I believed it. And you know, it was right, too. I did. I had that capacity that so many alcoholics do. When I was sober, even if I'd been drunk for a long time, when I sobered up, I would snap back quickly and look good. I was the kind of guy that would get routinely overrated by anybody. I'd go looking for a job, and all I wanted to do was lift boxes or something. They'd put me in charge. And I'd teach them how poor a judge of character they were. I was in charge of 151 people when I was 17 years old. Not for very long, but I had them for a while. Man, they were mine. Then they couldn't find their supervisor, so anyway, bad. But that was typical. You know, I would sober up. I would look good. In the military, I was that way. I went in. I was probably as big a goofball as has ever entered the ranks of the military. I made Gomer Pyle look like Oliver North. I was a meathead. I was a real meathead. But apparently I stayed sober long enough to make a good impression. And out of 1,000 men that I took training with, they picked me and four other guys as being the outstanding young men in that bunch. I still can't believe it. I tell you, that was dumb. And I know when they called my name as one of the four or five outstanding people, I said, huh? People around me who knew me said, huh? But they started to develop me into an officer, and then they let me get to town a couple times too many and said, no, you're not what we had in mind. So I spent my military career, if I disliked it before, I grew to hate it because I spent my military career, I didn't even know the place existed, up in the Aleutian Islands. I mean, there's nothing there. I mean, my God, islands sound like they ought to have a coconut tree or something. monkeys or something. Aleutian Islands got nothing. All it is a chain of rocks that go from Alaska and reach out toward Japan for no known purpose. I mean, they're just there. And the only purpose I saw is to take nice young boys from the South and put them up there in the Arctic to freeze to death. And I had an exotic tour duty. The only job I might have had other jobs, but the only one I can remember was guarding the rock. I'm standing on the rock, frozen, cold, good God. Didn't have the decency to snow down, snowed sideways. And wind never quit blowing. And I can still see myself, this tender flower of the South. And I'm up there standing on that rock with an iron hat on, holding a gun, and I guess I'm supposed to shoot somebody if they come steal that rock or something. I wouldn't have shot anybody. Man, I'd have helped them load the sucker if they'd let me get on the truck with it. Yeah, but anyway, that was, I say all that just to say this is sort of the cauldron from which I came. And so I was a guy that was just a real cut up of a guy. I wasn't an alcoholic when all of that stuff first started. I was just somebody who knew the ease and comfort that comes from a few drinks. I was a guy who knew the powerful solution that alcohol constituted for a guy like me. I was a guy who'd become infatuated with that sense of release and euphoria and stuff that came from a few drinks. And so I was hooked. When I got up on that island in that rock up there, somewhere in the middle of that, I developed alcoholism. Now, I didn't notice it when it happened, but the best I can tell, it happened. I was 18 years old, and the best I can tell is where we call it crossing a line. And I know that best from looking back, it happened when I was there on ADAC in the Aleutian Island. And, of course, I was quite drunk when I went over the line and probably paid no attention to it whatsoever. But when I look back, when I got sober, look back, I could see that's where it happened. And I developed alcoholism. And from that point forward, my life, you know, it never had been much, but from that point on, it went rapidly downhill. I was one of those people who was a fast bloomer. I think I was a prototype of the type of alcoholic that's just all over the place today. Yeah, I was one of those people that, it's amazing to me how quickly people get in trouble these days with the stuff that's available. My God, they'd just be a raving maniac by the time of 13 or 14 years old. I think I was an early model of that. And I was just somebody who just went ape. When I developed real alcoholism, I didn't know it, but my life was to never be the same, in the sense that if I took one drink, I could not predict what I would do. Now, it took me a long time to catch on to that. It took me a long time to understand that. In fact, I didn't understand it till well after I was in AA. But I never knew that there was anything like that happen. All I knew was that when I drank, I got into some awfully bizarre circumstances. And so that was the story of my life, just this kind of rapid fire, moving through life, achieving, losing. And what I failed to recognize is every time I achieved and lost, I ratcheted down. You know, our book is filled with a lot of stuff. One thing it's not filled with is any reference to something called denial. You won't find it in the book. And I don't think it's because Bill didn't know the word. He knew every word in every language. I believe the guy was a tremendous intellect. So I don't think it was that. I think he didn't use that word because it doesn't apply. You know, denial is sort of an intellectual process. It's sort of a fending off of encroaching ideas or whatever, unpleasant news. What our book refers to is exactly what I experienced. It's not denial, it's delusion. An inability to differentiate the true from the false, an illusion, an inability to see life as it is. And as I was crashing through life and going downhill in one fell swoop, I never really saw what was happening. It's a weird thing. There's no logic to explain it. I don't need to explain it to most of you. yeah, particularly those of you who are not alcoholic, because you probably observe it clear-eyed. And it's a mystifying behavior, how somebody can drink themselves into pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization and can't wait to do it again. That makes no sense to anybody, including the actor. But it makes the only thing that makes sense deep down inside. And so that's what I was. I was somebody that I was just crashing through life, and every time I fell apart and got captured and put in jail or hospital or psych ward or whatever they do with folks they capture, every time that would happen with me, I would start over and drop down a notch and drop down a notch till finally I wound up living a kind of a life that would have been unimaginable to me at one time. Yeah, I stayed in the military until they got tired of messing with me, and I was thrown out with an undesirable discharge for alcoholism when I was 20 years old. And you know about how much impact that had on me. You know, alcoholism back then was a moral condition, and nobody was alcoholic except some old wino in the alley. And so it had absolutely no effect on me whatsoever. I thought I'd finally get rid of that stupid outfit. And then when I hit the street, I just sort of wandered around, and I went wherever the illness took me. I'd just sort of take off with no rhyme or reason and just wander around, which explains why I was in the city of Flint, Michigan. If you've never been there, congratulations. It ain't worth the trip. I just spoke at the Michigan State Convention two or three weeks ago, and I got into a tear about Flint. I swear, I thought I was going to have to fight some of them Flint people. Again, I fought them before, but I thought I was going to have to fight them sober. But I noticed none of them invited me to come back and asked me if they could get them a job where I live. You know, so I'm not the only one worried out. Anyway, that's where I wound up. You got to be drunk to wind up there. And you really got to be drunk to stay there. And so I did. I worked in General Motors till my reputation got in front of me. And then in a city of 500,000 people where everything in town was General Motors, they would hire anything that could walk. And they turned me down. Man, I am a prize prospect. And I couldn't even get a job. I got blackballed in the town and couldn't get a job. Well, Jesus. And so it was their fault that I wound up being sort of a social character. I got unemployed and darn near unemployable in a time of boom employment. And I started just shifting just downwardly and not noticing what's happening. But every time I'd fail, start over, I would ratchet down. And what at one time in my life would have been unthinkable became remarkably normal. Started doing day labor, just working on anything I could get. For nothing. I remember one time I had a job pulling nails out of scrap lumber. You're a budding rocket scientist like me, and I'm pulling nails out, and got fired. I mean, God, no. You talk about adding insult to injury. Jesus. And so I was not good help, apparently, in any profession at that time. But that just kept right on, and then I finally wound up, I'm not proud of it at all. I never became a gangster or a predatory criminal. I became a social leech. You know, I was a guy. In the area of Flint, Michigan that I lived in, there were only two classes of people. There were the rollees, and that were folks who got rolled, and the rollers. And those were interchangeable roles. If you were the friskiest, you were the roller. If you were the weakest at a given moment, you were the rollee. And I tell you, when you got robbed in that environment, you didn't call the police because you never knew who was going to get arrested. I mean, anybody was eligible, so you wouldn't dare call anybody. So it's just the way the food chain worked there. Now, I wasn't reared to do that kind of stuff. But by the time I got there, it seemed remarkably normal. And I wasn't even conscious of the life. I was aware I was not on a roll. And I was aware that enough that I, as a young fellow in his early 20s, would look at myself in a mirror and just want to gag at what I saw. I was in enough anguish that I would look at myself, and the only thing I could think of with any clarity was, why don't you just end it, big guy? Everybody would be better off, and that was probably true. So it wasn't all just sort of cloudy stuff. There were those moments when I would take a look at some reality. But I never really saw what was happening to me. I was always living in the expectation that something's going to happen. And one of these days, I'm going to get my feet on the ground, look out world. That's really what I believed. I never truly believed I was alcoholic. A lot of people said I was, but I never agreed with any of them. I thought I was a guy with a lot of potential, that one day I was going to break loose. And so that's who I was. That's how I had rushed through life, and was just one of those people that was just kind of truly a social wrecking ball. Yeah, I was a guy that didn't do malicious stuff, but if I moved into a neighborhood, property values went down just because I was there. I mean, a neighbor like me is going to take the price down a little bit. And so that was pretty the kind of damage I did. But that's who I was, and that's the young fella that was sitting in that penitentiary. And so I was not, as you can gather, I was not a nice young fraternity fellow on the way to a party who had a tragic accident. I was a disaster waiting to happen. And it was just a matter of time until something happened. And I know that's true with many alcoholics, but thank God most don't experience the thing that so many of us do. And so that's who I was sitting there. And I went a lot longer than that, but decided to just go and visit with it a little bit, because that's what brought me here. I didn't get here by early intervention. I got here by absolutely life ending as it was fit to live. And so that was the young guy who came to his senses sitting in that maximum custody joint. Well, as you can well imagine, if you're looking back at a history like that, there's not much motivation for change. All there's motivation for is shame and disgust and bereavement. I was so full of guilt and remorse and shame, I felt ashamed to be breathing. And thinking of help or a new life was so foreign to me, it would not have even made the agenda of things on my mind. It was over. I was absolutely done. And that's what I saw when I looked back. A life that would have been truly better had it never happened. I couldn't think of a single human in the first 24 years of my life that wouldn't have literally been better off had it never known me. And so that's who I was. I was not a hothouse flower. And so I'm not proud of any of that. You can hurry up and believe. Even though I enjoy drunkologues, I guarantee you I'm telling you a story of shame and remorse and sorrow. Not bring back the good old days. That was just a travesty of humanity. But that's what I saw when I looked back. When I looked to the future, there was none. When I say I was done, that's exactly what I mean. I was done. It was over. I had no interest in a new life. I had no thoughts about a new life. I'm just sitting there, so much human wreckage filed away like a storage cabinet. And so that's who I am. And when I looked at the future, it was like looking in a dark cave. There was nothing there. And when I looked at the present, all I saw, well, I won't go into a lot of graphic detail, not that I would mind, but no real point. The penitentiary that I was in was filled with people from Flint, for one, and it really was. I knew a lot of them. And so I knew if it was filled with folks like us, it couldn't be a very nice place. And so I had no illusions about where I was. I didn't have any illusions about who I was. And I had no illusions about where I was. You know, I was living in an environment that defies imagination. In an environment where man's inhumanity to man is normal behavior. I mean, it's nothing extraordinary about it. It's just the way it works. It's the way the life is. A predatory and dog-eat-dog kind of an existence that I wasn't geared for. You know, that it's a place where kindness is considered weakness. Sincerity is thought of as stupidity. Love is a dirty word. It's not a good word. You know, and it's a kind of place that that I knew that my chances of survival in that environment would be slim. I was the youngest guy in the institution. Normally, they didn't keep people with my kind of crime in maximum custody. It doesn't mean a lot, but mine was what they call a casual offense. It doesn't mean it's minor, obviously. When you take two human lives, that's not casual. But it's casual in that it's classed as a crime that was an outgrowth of my alcoholism. It was not a predatory act, not a malicious act. It was just one of those things that unfortunately happens. It's criminal. No punishment could be adequate to deal with it. But it's a casual offense. It's not something that's apt to repeat. And so they normally don't keep people like that. And my age, people didn't. I was the youngest guy in the joint. Over 6,000 people locked up in that behind one wall, and I was the youngest one in there. They normally didn't keep people that age in there. But I guess they figured, as erratic as my history was, if they showed me daylight, I'd be gone. It doesn't matter. It's just speculation. I don't think I'd have been gone. I was done. I wouldn't have been going anywhere. I was done. Now, if you take a look at that guy, and I've given you just a real quick little snapshot. You take a look at that guy. I tell you this. I mean, it's just sort of conjecture again, but if you had gone through that penitentiary and looked at the 6,000 plus men in there and picked out folks that you would put on a potential winner's list, I am absolutely certain that even though I was the youngest guy in there, I would have been near the bottom of people that you would bet anything on. Yeah, I'm just an absolute blob of a guy sitting in a cell, totally isolated, didn't communicate with anybody. I was locked down. I was almost like a guy in a coma. Yeah, I was in such withdrawal and isolation that I didn't even acknowledge people around me. I knew they were there, but I didn't interact with them. They put me in a cell. I didn't know the person in the cell on either side of me. It wasn't that I was angry with them or antisocial. They just didn't exist. And so that's who I was. And I'll guarantee you, nobody would have picked me out as a potential winner. Nobody, especially me. So what does it take to turn around a life like that, eh? Yeah, a young guy who has done more damage than any human ever ought to be allowed to do in such a short period of time. And a life like that that's characterized by just constant failure. I was an absolute loser. What would you bet on? You know, there's nothing there. And yet, something happened to take a guy like that and introduce a turn, introduce a change. Now, I will assure you that it was not any effort on my part whatsoever. I was so beaten down at that point that I wouldn't have asked for a glass of water. I was so full of guilt and shame and remorse. I knew I didn't deserve anything, and I would have never asked for anything. If my coming to Alcoholics Anonymous had depended on any initiative from me, I would not be here. I'd absolutely guarantee you I would not be here. Because it wasn't that I was so rigidly opposed or in denial or delusion or anything else. It was just that I was so unworthy, I would never have asked anybody for help. And what happened was ridiculously simple. A guy who worked at that prison, it was a social work type of fellow that had come to work there, and he did one of those normal kind of intake interviews you do with folks, a little social history. I'd had a lot of those. My God, I could do them in my sleep. I'd had so many. Every time I'd get captured, people would do all kind of histories and evaluate me. I never had but one diagnosis in my life other than ugly. And it was always, you know, you're a bad drunk, you're an alcoholic, you're a problem drinker. I'd heard that all of my life. And so this guy did his thing. When he got through, he did the same old thing. He said, a little different than I'd normally heard, he said, "Man, you've had a lot of trouble with booze." And I said, "Yeah. I mean, my God, that was obvious. Anybody could see that. Trouble was my middle name." And I'd been in trouble all of my life and never sober. I've never been to jail sober. Never woke up in a burning car sober. My car. In the wrong state. I woke up one time married to a woman I didn't even know. I got acquainted very quickly. The next morning, I said, "Who might you be?" And she said, "Mrs. Ivester." I said, uh-oh. Bad stuff. Alimony is exactly the same. It doesn't make any difference whether you meant it or not. So, anyway, I mean, you know, so trouble, good God. Yeah, if you got trouble, boo, you bet I've had trouble with it. And then he said something I'd never heard. He said, "We have an AA group here, and I think you ought to go." Now, he might as well said we have a kamikaze pilot school here. I never heard of AA. I didn't know what it was. He didn't explain it. I'm not sure he knew. But he said, I think somebody had told him, that when you get a guy in front of you, you got a record like that, and it's all about booze, tell him you ought to go to A. Well, that's exactly what he did. Nothing more dramatic than that. He just made an observation, just like you guys lost. Excuse me, Dave. I have found a tour of Portland that ought to be marketed. We're going from point A to B, and we never hit a street for the entire time. We're in back alleys, cross fields. Yeah. Anyway, we got there, you know. I can tell what his history is like. It is something else. Yeah. And so, anyway, this guy said, you know, that we got a group you ought to go. And I think that's what somebody told him, that's what you ought to do with a guy like this. Now, had he left it at that, I would have never gone. I mean, I was so beaten that I wouldn't have responded to that. But it was at least a chink in the armor. And then a few days later, a week or two or whatever, there was a little slip of paper on my bunk. That's the way they delivered mail. They put it in on your bunk. And a little slip of paper said, "You can go to your first AA meeting February 2nd of 57. And I didn't want to go to AA. I didn't know what it was, but I didn't want to go to anything. If a guy is, and some of you I know have been in isolation, you know, understand something about isolation. When you're severely isolated, the last thing you want to do is go mix it up with anybody. Yeah, when they tell me you ought to go to something, I wouldn't have cared if it was a rock band. I wouldn't have wanted to go to anything. And what I wanted to do is sit in that cell and stare at my navel and do anything I could do to keep from thinking. That's what I wanted to do. But thank God for people who are informed enough to know what to tell an alcoholic. One of the reasons, those of you who know me, and that's quite a number here, know that I'm more than a little passionate about active outreach type of service. Because if it weren't for that, I will promise you you'd have a different cat here tonight. Because what happened, this guy just, it was nobody put a leash on me and led me to AA, but this guy put that little note, and thank God for surrender. Thank God for surrender. I was so beaten. You know what I mean? I was so beaten that there was no fight left. I mean, I couldn't even muster resistance. And when I got that note, I just responded to it. And I went to my first meeting on February 2nd of 57. I probably looked like a guy on Thorazine shuffling across that yard. I didn't want to go to A. I didn't want to do anything except isolate. But that had enough influence to just make me move over. There was no fear, no promise, no nothing. But it was a nudge to at the right time. And I walked into my first meeting. Had no earthly idea what to expect. None. And, well, I had ideas, but they had no basis. You know, somebody had told me AA stood for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I swear it looked like we could have found a better name for this deal than that. That does not sound like something you would aspire to be part of, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous. Secret drunks. I always wanted to be a loud, vocal drunk. I didn't want to be a secret drunk. I had no clue about what it was. And so I walked into that first meeting, and I didn't know I was starting a new life. I'm just a lifeless body, just being buffeted around, and I wandered in. One guy spoke to me, had an officer on the door, read my name, Ivester, yes, sir, sit down. And I sat down and listened to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Honest to God, never felt any more out of place anywhere in my life than I did in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've heard a lot of people talk about when they walked into AA, they knew they were home at last. I'll assure you that was the furthest feeling from my life at home. I thought I'd gotten on the wrong planet, man. That did not look like something I wanted to be in. Yeah, I'm 24 years old. I'm the youngest guy in the joint. And I tell you, I thought about it a lot of times of the your formidable barriers. And I know some of you are fairly new in the program, and you probably have barriers just like I do. They may be different. They may be worse. But I had a lot of barriers that were formidable for a guy like me. Now, in 1957, there were not many 24-year-olds coming off the production line. None that I saw. I was the youngest meeting in person in every meeting I attended for years. I got so doggone tired of being the youngster in the crowd, the novelty in the crowd. Man, I got patted on the head so much I ought to be brain dead. People telling me how lucky I was to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought, yeah, really? Yeah, I'm really on a roll, you know. Yeah. God. Yeah, I'm sitting here not only looking at what I'm looking at, but I'm sitting in something that looks like a geriatric ward that I'm in. Yeah, everybody in there had drunk more years than I even thought of being old. And I thought, what am I doing here? And I didn't a bit more feel it in place here. And so the barriers were enormous. I'll just give you a couple examples of what I'm talking about. Youth was certainly a huge barrier. That, you know, you can talk about identifying instead of comparing all you want to. But if you're sitting in the meeting and the person on either side of you outweighs you by 25 years of drinking, you're going to compare. And you're going to come out short. And that's what I was. Everybody around me had drunk more years than I was years old. And I felt totally out of place. And I heard people tell those Wild West stories about being drunk for 35 straight years and never sober. My God, I knew I wouldn't live 35 years. You know, I couldn't relate to that. I can throw up straight up in the air 10 feet and never get a drop on me. I'm sure those were very entertaining, colorful stories, but they didn't mean anything to me. You know, and I couldn't a bit more identify to that stuff than a man in the moon. And I was in AA for 2 years before I ever heard one single speaker with whom I identified. And when I heard the guy, there couldn't have been a more true polar opposite from me. I was kind of a junkyard dog. You know? And the first guy I ever identified with was a fella, I'll never forget him. His name was Lewis. And the guys brought him up from Detroit. He only came one time. And they brought him up from Detroit. I think they lied to him and told him they were going on a cookout somewhere. And he didn't know he was going to a penitentiary. And that's the scariest human I think I ever saw. The whole time he was in there, he kept looking behind him to make sure nobody's sneaking up on him. And they coerced him into speaking. He didn't want to speak. He didn't want to breathe. He wanted out. And they put him up in front of the grave, and he was so scared that he spoke in a falsetto. He sounded like Tiny Tim. His voice just squeaked out. And he told a little bit about himself. And that's the first guy I ever identified with. Now he was opposite me. But what he did was he talked about the alcoholism that's real. He talked about what it's like to die on the inside. He talked about what it's like to live in fear. To live in shame and remorse, not about being drunk for 80 years, you know, and all of this kind of junk, but he's talking about the real alcoholism that doesn't have to do with the material stuff, but has to do with the death of a human being when life still got to go on. And that's what I identified with. The first human that I identified with this program was as different in every other way from me as a person could be. So that was a huge barrier, this thing of youth, the barrier of alcoholism. I had no clue what alcoholism meant. I didn't know. I had no clue whatsoever. You know, back then, it was still very much a moral condition. The Medical Association had just started to kind of allude to alcoholism. They didn't particularly declare an illness, but about the time I came in, they just started to allude to it as being like an illness. You know, it was enough to crack the door, to at least to start. But in this society, the belief was that it was a moral condition. It was a belief to me. When I first heard people talking about alcoholism being an illness, I found that an embarrassing concept. I thought, what on earth is an illness about being drunk? It made no sense, and I had absolutely no sense of that. There was a huge barrier. When I'm ignorant of the condition, I know I'm too young to have it, if there is such a condition, huge barrier. You can imagine without any explanation that the barrier of unworthiness. The barrier of unworthiness. I don't know if you've ever felt that, but I have sat in meetings and the other people in the meetings, they seem to me to be so superior, so much more clean, decent citizens than some kind of a subhuman like me. And I felt so unworthy that I was ashamed to be in AA, not because I was too good, because I was too bad. And so it was a huge barrier. My first challenge and a major barrier was being willing to live. Never mind not drinking, but being willing to live. When I was so full of guilt and shame and remorse for what I'd done, and so what I'm describing to you is a very tenuous kind of hold on even being in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then what it takes to get through that. It's now 11:30. I don't know how to reset my watch. Somebody will have to give me a signal. Mr. President, will you give me a signal? Ex-President. But that's who I was. Yeah, that's where I was sitting. And I'll tell you, now here I am, sober ever since. And I cannot tell you how grateful I am for the things that made a difference for me. When I went into AA, I didn't know it until I became a part of it and saw what I had. I didn't know it, but I had gone into an excellent group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The recovery group at the State Prison of Southern Michigan in Jackson was an excellent group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just as good as any I know today. And unfortunately, I can't say that about the institution now. I was just up there and inquired about it. I wanted to go in, but anyway, I won't even go into all that. I'll just say that I said to the folk at that convention that I was so grateful that I was there in 1957 instead of 2007, because I was in a great group supported by some tremendous outside supporters. Today, there's not a single person going into that prison to carry a message. And that is heartbreaking, heartbreaking. But it's what's happened. And I told them I'm extremely grateful that I was not trying to find AA in Michigan this year. So it's just one of those things that's unfortunately happened in the fellowship. But my blessings were enormous. Because that was an excellent group. And what I mean by that, I mean, it was not some place that had cookouts and parties and stuff like that. But it was a solid group that understood the primary purpose of AA and carried it out as well as any group I have ever seen. It was a group that had the sensitivity to recognize people that looked like they were hungry for something or in bad need of it. And I think I was in the latter category. And so what that group would do would be to take new guys coming in the group, spin them off into a separate room. Back then, we didn't take people through the steps and all that stuff like we do today. That stuff hadn't been developed yet. But what they did was explain the program of recovery. And that was enormously helpful to me. And I'm talking about other guys in the joint, just like me. I'm not talking about my heroes from outside. I'm talking about other guys in the joint. And it did a tremendous amount for me. You know, that group kind of, it's a funny thing about a group. You know what I'm talking about? A well-formed group that has sense of belonging. A group will pick up on people with an uncanny sign of sensitivity. You can sense when somebody either needs a nudge or a push or a pat on the back, that'll happen. And that's what happened. I think some guys picked up on me and some guys started saying, "Hey, Tom, come on, go with us." That's how I got introduced. I never heard. I didn't know I was in service. You know, guys just say, "Come on, go on with us." And I said, "What are you going to do? Don't worry about it. Come on." And that's how I got introduced. Nobody ever asked me if I wanted to. That's just what we did. And so I got started in an excellent group. I became one of the guys who would go meet with the new guys. And it was amazing to me that I'd even be doing such a thing, that I would even be going to the meetings. I started fumbling through the steps. You know, I didn't know exactly what I was doing, but I didn't know that's one of the best ways to do it. I just started fumbling around. And what I found is that if you do the steps to the best of your ability, as honestly as you know how, you can't screw it up. And even as sloppy as I did it, boy, it worked. To the extent that I had an absolutely transforming experience in Alcoholics Anonymous in a maximum custody penitentiary. Nobody needs to tell me this is not a powerful program. This is a powerful program. Because in an environment as bizarre as what I described, I was able to become a free man. In every sense of the word except physically. I became a free spirit. I became a man who lived with peace and dignity and some joy for the first time in my entire life because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything that comes to an individual who's recovered in this program came to me in a maximum custody penitentiary. I experienced the first joy, the first dignity, the first worth I'd ever felt in my life, locked up like a wild animal in a zoo. Amazing thing. And I tell you, I won't belabor much this, but I'll tell you a transforming thing for me. Of course, the most important step is all of them. They're a package deal. There's not any most important. But there was one that was truly sort of the fulcrum of the program, where it sort of took form and found a place in my life. Yeah, I was sort of going through and getting a feel for it and all that kind of thing. But when I got to fourth step, I didn't intend to take a fourth step and probably didn't do a very great job from an editorial standpoint. If you looked at it from a quality view, you would probably say, "Geez, that's lousy work." But I'll tell you this, when I did that fourth step, it was the most important day's work I have ever done in my life. Now, it wasn't any analytical kind of thing laid out with columns and all kinds of evaluation. What it was the rendering of a tortured young man pouring out his heart. That's all. And when I got through with that, something fundamentally important had changed in my life. I have never been the same man from that day to this day. When I got through with that inventory, I knew at a cellular level that I was alcoholic. Period. Alcoholic, period. Not the young guy, the tragic case, the whiz kid, none of that. I'm alcoholic. I'm somebody who, if I drink, I cannot predict what I'll do. And I accepted that at the core of my being. Our book says that we concede to our innermost selves that we're powerless, that we're alcoholic. The first step in recovery, and that's exactly what I did that day. And I've never been the same man since, in the sense that I know that battle was over, fellow alcoholics. That battle was over, never to be resumed unless I make one fatal mistake, and that's take a drink. The physical illness of alcoholism will never bother me again. I do an MRI every once in a while, about once every 60 years, and they don't say, "My God, look, this boy's an alcoholic. You know, I look like any other human." That illness is no factor in my life unless I take a drink, and then look out. Look out. And I know that. And what I'm left with is this weird, strange mind of the chronic alcoholic. And what this, I'll just say it this way because I know that the president's going to be yanking my chain here in just a minute. The way I looked at it, I'll just sort of cut to the chase on this, and I know that brilliant Oregon people can fill in all the blanks. That when I look at the steps, I look at three basic packages of action. The first three, to me, are a unit. They're a solid unit that essentially, they're not so much recovery. They're setting up a spiritual relationship, a foundation from which recovery can develop, from which recovery can grow. Tremendously important. I know many people, some people, who have never pretended to go beyond three steps, who have never drunk again. You know, this program here is a kind of a, you call your own shot in this deal. You quit at whatever you're willing to settle for. Nobody can tell you whether you pass or fail. You know, the only thing to tell you that is about what you do. And so it's not a matter of that. That stop at what you're willing to settle for. And if I was willing to settle for just not drinking one day at a time, I think I could have done very well with those first three steps. But that's not enough for me. I have alcoholism. My problem was not that I drank too much. My problem is that I have a mind that is just unbelievably difficult to deal with. I have a mind that can and has at times turned irresistibly to the thought of a drink, even after years of sobriety. You know, I have that kind of mind. So I need something more. And so the next couple of steps, the fourth and fifth, deal with causes and conditions. What is it that makes my mind like that? What is it that makes it so difficult for me to have working relationships with people? What is it that makes it so difficult for me to have good, close, trusting, loving relationships with women? You know, that's always been a nemesis. You know, what's the deal here? What is it that gives me that sort of down in the dumps feeling over nothing, that sense of restlessness and discontent? You know, and so that's what those other steps are for, is how to live at peace and so that I don't need to drink. And those causes and conditions and doing that inventory, which was such a truly defining moment for me. And then 6 and 7 comes up, which are vital. You know, where I've got a foundation, I've taken a look at causes and conditions, then I come to 6 and 7. I like to keep things simple so I can understand them. 6 and 7 says, you want to change or don't you? You've taken a look. You've seen what alcoholism looks like. You've seen what your life looks like. You've taken a look. You know what drives this machine in such a crazy direction. You want to change or don't you? You want to get better? You want to try to work both sides of the street? Are you willing to say no when yes is so enticing? It's decision time. And if so, then I'm ready to take the steps of restoration. And I tell you this, I don't want to discourage you, but I know there's some fairly new people here. You do get better in Alcoholics Anonymous incrementally over time, usually. And what happens, I tell you, that decision, even when followed by the actions, is, well, I put it like this. In a little over 50 years, I have never consciously solved one single problem in Alcoholics Anonymous. Not a one. I've never been sitting in a meeting and said, Eureka, now got it. Now understand. Not once. I never have had God perform a lobotomy on me and remove a defect of character. It's not that way. You know, that set of steps is about being ready to change and being willing to ask God to remove these deaths, and the answer is through the other steps, 8 through 12. I'll just comment briefly about what I think are the freedom steps, 8 and 9. You know, I believe that. Well, I'll tell you what my belief is and what my action is. I think an awful lot of people, when I'm working with people who are going through the steps and I lose them, almost invariably it's at the point of 6 and 7. It's 6 and 7. Where they may be ready, but they'll tend to slip off into some sort of a maintenance program. And rather than taking overt actions in the program, we'll tend to get into sort of just going to meetings. You're going to meetings as if the meetings are the solution, and not getting into the heavy lifting that's involved in the amends process. My belief is that that's short-term victory. Doesn't make it right, but it's my belief. Is that when I'm ready to change and those defects care, my belief is that every time I screwed over, abused, misused, mistreated people, I didn't win, I lost. And I paid for it with a piece of my soul. And I will never be a free man until I go back and make right those wrongs. I'll drag them forever. They won't drive old age. They won't go away by malnutrition from not feeding them. They'll be there forever unless I take the action to be rid of them. And that's what the amend steps are, is to identify the people, places, and things where I've done harm. And then to go and try to make right those wrongs. Try to make direct amends to those people. I'll just tell you this, that I was able, now I had grievous amends, I had a lot of them. I was able to make an appreciable amount of action on doing amends even while I was locked up. You know, in most of the cases, you know, the amends that needed to be made had to do with violation of principles, violation of trust, violation of people in ways that really mattered, where they hit them, where they hurt. You know, in my case, that obviously I had grievous amends. I'd taken two human lives, and not only with the two victims of the crime, but with the two families involved. And those were amends that had to be made that ate my lunch 24 hours a day. There's something I had to do. And I was able to make beginnings on those amends while I was still locked up. I was able to make direct amends in every way that I could to the victims. And for the rest of my life, I will always be involved in indirect amends in relation to the victims. There's no question that's where some of my zeal comes from, because a lot of what I do is directly related to amends process. The real critical thing was how to make amends to the families. Both families had communicated to me when I signaled to them that I wanted to try to communicate. They said no. They didn't want to hear from me. Our step says that we don't find our relief at others' expense. And so you have to honor that. And so I did one thing I don't normally do. I added a word to the eighth step, which says we made a list of people who had harmed, became willing to make amends to them all. I added the word forgiveness. No, opportunity. Opportunity. Added the word opportunity. I prayed for willingness and opportunity to make those amends. Now, I swear to you, I never did one single thing to cause that to happen. But I asked my higher power to give me that opportunity, and sure enough, it did, with absolutely no direct initiative on my part. I won't go into the whole story. I'll just say, if anybody here's got grievous trouble in amends like that, I'd be glad to talk with you. I'd be glad for you to get in touch with me. I'd be glad, because those are tough, tough things to deal with. But I had the opportunity to go and meet with both families and make direct amends to the two families involved. So what we're dealing with here truly is a powerful program. And it's only in doing those things where I go back and deal with those phantoms that eat my lunch daily basis that freedom starts to come. And so that did. And then the rest of the steps 10 through 12, they're a peculiar setup to me. They, if you might check this out when you go home if you don't believe this. When you move past the amends process, there's a strange little transition that occurs, at least in my mind, that when we get through with the eighth and ninth step, to have the promises. You know, it talks about all the wonderful things that will happen as a result of doing these actions before we're halfway through. And then it shifts. And I think what happens from that point on is that everything that's laid out in the steps thereafter certainly has to do with some things to maintain our spiritual condition. But every action is followed by directions toward others. And everything in those steps is predicated on the notion is that the way you deal with a self-centered condition like alcoholism is by being centered on others. And everything in the program from that point forward has to do with real action to try to carry this message to other people and to try to make a contribution in the world. I could tell you 10,000 stories about the things that come when you just practice simple stuff like that. There isn't a day of my life that I don't have rich blessings from simply trying to be sensitive to opportunity to be of service everywhere that I go, and they never fail to happen. So enormous stuff happens in there, and the joy never ends because that thing of being, instead of focusing on me, of trying to focus on others. And I'll tell you the thing that I'll wrap up on, Mr. President, is that I had an unbelievable history. I still am having an unbelievable history. I was a guy that I didn't have any real aspiration when I came in this program other than to just be a functioning human for once. And when I left the institution, I stayed in there 3.5 years. Then they told me they'd turn me loose if I would agree to North Carolina. And I asked if they'd let me consider that. Yeah, you know I did. I said, yeah, I would have gone to ADAC up in the Aleutians if it wanted me to go. But I'm sure. And so I went back to North Carolina. And I know everybody here has come out of some kind of cage. An institution is just one kind of cage. There are others that are a jammed up marriage or a career that's on the rocks or what, name it. We've all come out of cages and emerged and stepped into the sun with a lot of fears. Yeah, we all do. And we have fears about whether we'll ever be able to find a normal place in society and we'll ever be able to just function comfortably and all this stuff. And most of the fears are pointless. And mine were too. When I stepped out of prison, I desperately wanted to be a free man. And I knew that AA was my lifeline. There was no question what I would do. And I got immediately active when I got out. And I had dreams. I had just the little dreams that anybody has. Mine might have been a little different than average. I wanted to be a citizen. I never had been. I never was somebody that contributed to community life. I was never somebody. I had never voted in my life. I never paid taxes in my life unless they took it away from me. I never did send anything to anybody. Never filled out a form. Didn't even know you had to do that. I guess, I don't think, I never did do it anyway. Never had voted, and so I just wanted to do stuff like that. I wanted to work on a job, make a living. I wanted to be a citizen and do those kinds of things. And that's about all I really wanted. I seriously wondered if anybody, for obvious reasons, would ever trust me to do anything. And this is not melodrama, it's a fact, that I really wondered if I would ever have a friend that trusted me. I mean, that's just kind of logical thinking for somebody coming out of that kind of a history. And I'm here to tell you that dreams come true. I had a job waiting for me before I ever got out of the penitentiary. My family got it for me. And it wasn't much of a job, but it sure beat what I was doing. Man, I'm telling you, I was sweeping the floor in a mill. Midnight shift, all night long. And I was the most exuberant floor sweeper you've ever seen in your life. Man, I loved that job. And got immediately active. The first day I was on the street, I got immediately active and have been that way ever since. Second week I was out, I went to a prison. Guys told me, come on, go to prison. I said, man, they're not going to let me in one of those places. I just got out of one. And if I go in, they may not let me out. And so I was a little antsy, but I went in. Now, here it is. You talk about being restored. You talk about opportunities that come. 2 months after I was out, same guy who had doubts he would ever be trusted by anybody to do anything, I was named outside sponsor of the prison, not the one I was in, but the prison that I'd visited. They asked me to be a trusted servant, a leader, to carry a program into it, just like we were talking about, Rick, that trusted me to go in and be a leader in that. And I just got out. I mean, that was amazing. I couldn't have been more affirmed if they'd elected me governor. I thought it was just a wonderful thing. About the same time, my parole guy came to me one time, just a couple months out. Now, for obvious reason, owing to a crime like mine, I was on my parole papers, it said this man's never operated a motor vehicle. I accepted that as a fact of life. I never expected to operate a, didn't even think about it, that I never expected to operate a motor vehicle again. And I could fully understand. My parole guy came to me one day and said, Tom, you're real active in this AA thing. And I said, yes, sir. And it concerned me because I thought he was going to tell me to slow down, and I knew I wouldn't, because that's just not the way it would work. And I knew I wouldn't do that. And he said, wouldn't it help you if you could drive? And I said, yes, sir, but I can't, you know, like he didn't know. And so he said, well, let me check it out. A little later, he asked me, now, this story is absolutely true. Everything about it. It sounded like a fairy tale, but the story is absolutely true. He called me after a little while, and he said, meet me at the Sears store uptown. And that's where it happened to be that the driver's license agency was. And I went into that store. Sister drove me up there. Walked in the store, went back to the back of the store. My guy was standing there with a fellow who turned out to be the license agent. They finished their conversation, turned to me, and the guy said that I didn't know, said, he tells me that you might be interested in having a driver's license. And I said, well, yes, sir. And now, don't ask me to explain it. Carl, you could probably, well, I don't know if I'm going to tell you or not. You may report me. I know that what he did is not legal. I know that. But this guy turned to me, didn't even know me, never seen me before, and handed me a driver's license. He didn't even ask me if I could drive. He already had it made out. And didn't ask me if I could drive. No test of any kind whatsoever. Didn't even pay for it. That's not the way it works. But I tell you, I have long since quit challenging God's work. You know, what I truly believe, no, I don't believe it. What I know without any question is that when God's got work for us to do, the walls come down. I don't care what they are. The walls come down. Hear what I said. When God's got work for us to do, not when I think I ought to drive, but when God's got work for me to do, the walls come down. Unbelievable experience. 5 months after I was out, the same guy who wondered if he'd ever have a friend or be trusted by anybody, I was elected the district committeeman for my district. The AA members in 15 cities, my closest family, asking me to be their trusted servant. Unbelievable thing. And yeah, I'd gone to, not gone to, but I had gotten 2 years from Michigan State while I was locked up. I could barely spell DCM. But I took the job, and man, I gave it everything I had. 2 years after I was out, I was contacted one day by somebody at the prison headquarters in my state. And it was a man that I'd met one time. I didn't know him, but he'd stuck his head in the door of the AA meeting that I was sponsoring. And somebody, I think, had told him to just say hi to me. And so he came in, introduced himself. We chatted 2 minutes. So I didn't know him at all. And it was him on the phone that called my house, and he said, Mr. Ivester. I said, yes, sir. He said, we're expanding the rehabilitation program in our prison system. And we were wondering if you would consider accepting a position. Now, I tell you, that would still be a little bit out of character today. The day of that phone call, there had never been an ex-con in the history of this planet, never, hired to a professional position in a prison system. I knew that. And when he said that, the first thing I said was, do you know who you're talking to? And he said, yeah, we know. We've checked you out. But that had never happened. And so I said, I would rather do that than anything I could imagine. And to myself, I said, there ain't no way. Say it again, when God's got work for us to do, the walls come down, even those. And I was hired in 1961, the first ex-con in history hired into a prison system. And I tell you, it's a weird thing. If you want to come to appreciate the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, go to a place where man has never gone and where there's no counsel to be had from people with experience. And AA tradition did more for me to guide through a stormy sea than anything I ever learned in universities or any place else. The tradition served me well. And I was able to have a professional career that was an unbelievable thing. I'd always been I think by nature I was a good worker, but my equilibrium was very poor when I drank. And I tended to not look good on the job because I'd fall a lot. But I was by nature a good worker, and I went to work, gave it my all. And a funny thing happens when you give your all. I started getting recruited for other positions. I tell you, you can believe it or not, but I have absolutely no reason to embellish anything. From the day that I got my first job in recovery, which was gotten by my family, until I retired from my career 39 years later, I never applied for one single position. Promotion, transfer, pay raise, nothing. Funny thing, when you do good work, there's a hunger for good, loyal type employees. There's a hunger for leadership. And I had no ambition. I'd have been totally happy with the first job I ever had. But I started getting pulled into supervision and then into management. And then one day the head of our system gave me a call and said, come by, I want you to do something for me. And I thought he wanted me to pinch hit, making a talk or something. So I went out, yeah, boss, what? He said, Tom, I want you to take over an institution as warden. I swear to God, that still sounds ludicrous to me. It really did that day. When I got up off the floor, I said, boss, come on, man. I said, what are you talking about? And so he told me, he said, I really want you to take over an institution. And I said, come on, man, I don't want to be the head screw. That's what I told him. I don't want to be the head screw. And he said, well, I want you to do it. And so anyway, I asked him what he had in mind. He told me, and he had just enough creativity that he had me. You know, I'm that kind of guy. I'm somebody that I've got a sort of a nervous restlessness to do better in. So if I build something today, I guarantee you I'm working on the next increment tomorrow. He knew that, and that's what he wanted. And so I agreed to it. And I tell you, it's a weird position. You know, when you're a guy with a history like mine and you're sitting in a policy-level position in state government like that, and there'd be a lot of times I'd be sitting in budget meetings or something in the legislature, in some committee meeting with the governor or something like that, and I'd find myself with that little uneasy feeling. These people really know about me? I'm halfway through, somebody say, hey, what are you doing in here? But, of course, it never happened, and I had an absolutely marvelous career. I wouldn't have traded it for anything. I wouldn't have traded with Bill Gates. I tell you, it was just an absolutely phenomenal, rewarding career. A lot of heartbreak, but deep, deep, satisfying rewards and professional challenge that never waned. Today, I'm as active as any man I know. I'm as busy as any man I know for as long as any man I know. And I'm not in any race or anything. It's just the way it is. I'm somebody who's caught up in the joy of living, and I find that the more I do, the more energy I have. I don't get tired, I don't get worn out, I get pumped up. So it all comes from this thing of just giving myself to the program and letting it take me where it will. And man, it's taken me places I would not have even dared knock. If you're somebody who really wants some fire in the life, I tell you, my honest belief is that genuine service in Alcoholics Anonymous is the surest key to victory in that. There's nothing that's more deeply satisfying, rewarding, invigorating than that thing of actively being involved in carrying this message to other folks. That's been the key to everything successful in my life. Now, I know I've gone a long time because the president wouldn't tell me when to quit. And so I appreciate your staying with me. I appreciate your listening. And I appreciate being with you. Thanks so much. You got it. Thank you.